have always spoken to my work being about the intersection of race and class and sexuality, but I always kind of back-ended into it. I started writing this play and I thought, you know what? This is about race. I'm not going to pretend it's a play that's just about how these people who just happen to be these different races bounce off each other, and such is the landscape of America and blah, blah, blah. This is my there-it-is kind of play. So said Lydia Diamond in a Boston Globe interview. Her 2014 play, Smart People, tackles racism head-on. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Joining me today to discuss and sample the play Smart People is Chuck Smith, award-winning Chicago director, brought in to direct University Theater's production of Smart People here in Madison, and three of the four actors from the February 2016 production of the play. We have Daniel Milhouse, plays the part of Brian, Lucy Tan as Ginny, and Kyle Agee as Jackson. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to ask you about the playwright, Lydia Diamond, and the choice of this particular play, Smart People. The last time I saw a Lydia Diamond production, I think, was her adaptation of Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye, which was done here in Madison some years ago. But tell us about Lydia Diamond and also about this play in particular.
Well, I've known Lydia for over, I'd say, close to 20 years now. One of her plays won a contest that I used to have at when I was teaching at Columbia College, The Gift Horse. And I did The Gift Horse. It was done at the college. I didn't direct it at the college. But then I liked it so much, I talked to the artistic director at the Goodman Theater, where I'm resident director, into doing it. And it was a really fine production. And that was one of the, so far, that was one of the highlights of our working together. But we've worked together on another wonderful play of hers called Stickfly, which eventually went to Broadway. I did the world premiere at Congo Square, and I just recently did another production of it last year at a new theater in Chicago called the Windy City Players. But this play, Smart People, is probably the most on-the-edge play that it's gonna take some people by storm in terms of finding it. Some will find it offensive, and some will, you know, just, it tells it like it is. That's what it is.
Well, and she says that more or less in her interview comments, that rather than just sort of hinting around race, she's going to take it head on.
Yeah.
Well, let's set up the four characters who are in this play, because there are four smart people.
They're all smart people. That's there.
And we'll talk about that title. But let's see, since we've got three of the actors here, of the four, why don't each one of you tell us who your character is in the play, you know, describe this person, the job, the personality, everything else. And then Chuck,
I'll talk about the...
You can talk about Valerie, who's not able to be with us today. Well, let's start with you, Daniel, who plays the part of Brian.
Yeah, I'm Daniel. I play the part of Brian White, who is a cognitive neuroscientist at Harvard, and he is trying to prove that all whites are fundamentally racist, that it's biologically in our blood pattern, in our brains, and that's basically the nutshell right there.
And he gets into trouble for that.
Oh, yeah, he gets into trouble.
Okay, what about his personality, separate from the fact that this is the work he's doing?
Sure. He's very confident in his work and very passionate. He truly believes that the work he is trying to accomplish is going to help the world, going to help society. And so he's kind of blinded, I think, by that passion because he gets so many obstacles. And I don't deal with it in the best way. You know, I tell everyone to, you know, roll up their sleeves and to suck it the f*** up and everything at one point. His heart is there with me. My heart is there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Although you have your own kind of blindness, too, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every character maybe isn't as smart as they think they are, even if they are at Harvard.
Just like in real life.
Yes. All right. And then, Lucy, you play the part of Ginny.
Yes, I play Ginny Yang, and she is the youngest tenured professor in psychology at Harvard University.
And tell us about her ethnic background.
She is half Chinese and half Japanese, and she actually refers to herself as the preeminent voice of all Asian Americans, although I wouldn't say that she's necessarily arrogant. She is also a very confident person. She's worked really hard to get to the place that she feels, you know, she deserves and has not by any means been handed to her. And she is very controlling. She's a perfectionist, and she has set very high standards for herself, and she's also really passionate about what she does.
She also seems to have a shopping addiction.
She does have a shopping addiction, yes. I think that is one of the aspects in which we see Ginny's character crack, and I think it makes her really complex.
Yeah, all four of the characters in the play seem to, they're both on one level, they seem like stereotypes or almost cartoonish characters, but then there's something that Lydia Diamond adds that makes it a little bit more nuanced or complicated than that. All right, so we've got Kyle, you are playing the part of Jackson. Tell us about Jackson.
I am. Jackson is an African-American surgeon. He's interning, basically doing like a surgical rotation, and the plot of the play essentially covers his struggles in the process of navigating that. Jackson is definitely a very complex character. He brings his upbringing into the situation as a mix with his professional, you know, life, and there's definitely some struggles there.
Tell us about his brother.
His brother is a drug addict. His brother has caused a lot of problems for his family, and so he finds himself having to basically deal with that as an issue. And I think there's been scenes where, like, you know, they weren't the most comfortable with him dealing with that.
That part of his life. That's right. And then the other character not here though is the part of Valerie. So Chuck, can you tell us about Valerie?
Oh, well, yeah. Valerie basically is the voice of the playwright. In Valerie, I see an awful lot of Lydia Diamond. Valerie is an actress, a professional actress. This is what she does. This is how she makes her living. And she's very good at it. Lydia Diamond was once an actress. She started off as an actress and wasn't getting enough roles, so she used her other talent. And she started writing roles for herself, and then those roles turned into plays. And now she's a full-fledged living playwright and a very good one. And so the fact that she is a very good actress with a well-rounded education, she's one of the smart people. And she can, you know, her opinions are valid. You know, it's because she's an artist doesn't mean that she hasn't got anything up in her head. And that's what, that's Valerie, pretty much it is.
And there's some poignancy in the parts where she's auditioning. You know, she does Shakespeare and Ibsen, but then she's auditioning for a part where they really want to have her speak in dialect and, you know, play a certain kind of stock character to pigeonhole her in a certain way.
Yeah, but, you know, she, as an actress, she gives it her best. And but there's all kind of different roles that she has to audition for, and that's the life of an actress.
With house cleaning on the side.
She does house cleaning on the side because she has to, you know, supplement her income.
There's an interesting scene too where when she's in the hospital and she assumes that Jackson is not the doctor because he's black. So
right.
Even though you have these two African-American characters in that scene, she makes the standard assumption, well, he couldn't be the doctor.
Right. Yeah, well, that's typical. That's nothing unusual.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who said, well, here you got four characters and, you know, you've got the white professor with the last name of White. That's kind of blatant. And then you've got, for the Asian American character, you've got one half Chinese, half Japanese, you know, very driven, less sort of emotional on the surface than some of the others. And then you've got the African American doctor who's angry, dealing with sort of his angry black man side with the drug addict in the background. How would you just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
How does this play then not perpetuate stereotypes?
Because we see them in action, and we understand the situations that they're in, and we can easily identify with these characters. You know, each one of them. We meet them, and we because they're so well written, we understand what they're going through, and that's the heart of any character in a good play, is to understand the character's point of view, and whether you agree with it or not, at least you understand it and know why they are behaving the way they behave. And that's what Lydia Diamond does so well.
She sets it at Harvard with Harvard staff, and at the time with Barack Obama's inauguration,
which is where she was during that. She spent close to 12 years on the. Her husband was a professor of Henry Louis Gates. Worked under Henry Louis Gates right there at Harvard. So, and she was right there in the thick of all of that during the inauguration.
Besides the literal fact that this was her environment as a playwright, how does the inauguration of Barack Obama, which is referred to in the epilogue, the end of the play, how does that provide an important backdrop to what's happening and being discussed?
Well, it's indicated throughout the script that, you know, when he's running for president, and none of the characters who speak of him actually believe that he's going to win. Mm-hmm. He can't win. That's what they keep saying. He can't win. You know, this is America. But he does. And then, you know, everyone's taken aback but very thrilled and proud once it happens.
Well, let's set up a scene where we can hear some of these characters. And sometimes they seem to be, I don't know how you're staging it with this February 2016 production in Madison, but sometimes it's as if they each have a separate life going on, but we're bouncing back and forth between these different characters talking. How is that going to be represented visually when you come into the theater?
Well, in one of the early scenes, we see them in each of their sort of respected areas, four characters, four separate spaces, and they deliver monologues from each, you know, from each one of the four spaces. But then the space is sort of neutralized, and things happen all over the theater.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could hear sort of some of these beginning speeches where Brian is teaching and is going to kick out some students. And you've got then coming up pretty quickly after that, Jackson and Ginny going back and forth, too.
Sure. We could start Brian off easy enough.
Please disabuse yourselves of this notion that I am obligated to teach you. Neither do I have an obligation to bestow upon you my, and I cite Harvard Review 2002, effortless charisma and probingly insightful tutelage. I am obligated only to show up and talk for 2 hours twice a week. Note my frustration. I am not frustrated because I see in you some sort of great collective untapped potential. I am frustrated only because I will never have these 2 hours back. With the exception of three noteworthy students, you have all failed miserably. So, Mr. Goldstein, Ms. Jones, and Mr. Schwarg de Gala, did I say that correctly? It seems you have distinguished yourselves as capable of not merely regurgitating information, but of actually absorbing and metabolizing it. You are excused from today's lecture. Really? You can go. I'm giving you the day off for being smart. Go! Thank you. So, we shall begin again, yes? Shake it off. Good. Now, please, someone tell me not what it is, but what it implies.
And then Jenny comes in.
We interviewed 350 third-generation Asian American women. I will explain if you can please just let me...
I did not raise my voice to Dr. Sandeep. No. No. I simply pointed out the necessity of...
Yes, Asian is broad. Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese. Could we hold all questions until after I've laid out the... That's a good question. If I could... If we could just... You! Stop that!
No. I categorically reject that. It was the first digit on the patient's left foot.
My findings debunk Western assumptions naming primary reasons for anxiety and depression in Asian American women as familially induced.
Because it was the right thing to do. I asked Dr. Sandeep for permission to remove it. I'm trying to tell you. Damn.
Disparaging of Western culture. Really? Pejorative? No.
I asked Dr. Sandeep for permission. He nodded in agreement. I thought he nodded in agreement like this. Absolutely, a prophylactic amputation was warranted. You have to take the patient's circumstances into account.
Red shirt. Yes, 85% is what it says, factoring in the growth variable and dividing by the... Yeah, very good, 85%. You're all very good at math, hands down. I ask you again, what does it mean? These numbers represent people. Real people who breathe and work and f***. And they don't have time for you to sit in rooms and speculate about the 2% of the 75.3% that when factored into A equals an aggregate of some bull****, and then write a goddamn paper that states just how you arrived at that number.
Our findings beg for a contextual framework.
I'm talking context. If you look at the patient, not his chart, but go and look at him. No, you looked at his insurance status. Hell yes. Yes, that's exactly what I'm implying.
To a person, you've done backflips to talk around what these numbers prove. I've given you stats from biology, neurology, psychology, and psychiatry. I've even thrown in a little quantitative sociological research. There is only one answer. Your job is to be brave and state it and show how the numbers support it. Be the scientists persecuted for voicing that which is not palatable. What's the most non-palatable conclusion these stats could render? Is it that you don't know? Or that you can't bring yourself to say it? Anyone? My God. But they've beaten it out of you already.
He's a 73-year-old, overweight, diabetic with a compromised heart, high blood pressure, and a recorded history of bad self-care habits. The toe needed to go. Three. The other residencies didn't work out. Neuro, cardio, ortho. Because I'm your best doctor. 2 months night rotations. Again. Damn, I won't.
The subjects perceived cultural assumptions about them as timid, sexually promiscuous, and scholastically dexterous.
I would not describe myself as a hothead. I just need you to listen to me.
One young woman, we'll call her Ming, described her experience as a cultural dance of assumption, tradition, and shame.
Well then, f*** you. No. I'm sorry. Was that disrespectful? What I meant to say was f*** you.
I refuse to say it for you. So, one more time. We return to the differentials. The stereo content model predicts differentiated variables.
I can see how that was disrespectful. Please, accept my apology. Emergency, nights, I understand. Thank you.
That's about it.
You know, it's very unusual to have all characters like this talking not together. You know, we're used to coming into a theater and seeing, like in A Raisin in the Sun, where you have a family and they're talking to each other. In this case, you've got dramatic monologues where there's some kind of audience and event happening. But
yeah. Yeah, well, that's typical Lydia Diamond. She likes to break the fourth wall.
Yeah. Well, let's unpack some of what we just heard. So we've got Brian in this lecturing mode, and when he's referring to this thing that they won't say, that they're afraid to say, that's what you were talking about with the results showing that whites are hardwired to be racist?
Yeah, exactly. Because in a later scene, he's actually talking to the dean of the school, of his, you know, area. And he's being, you know, he got an email saying that I was racist for kicking out all the students of color. And I'm trying to argue that, saying, no, I didn't do that. I kicked out the ones who actually understood what I've been saying. And he goes on to say essentially that the white people change the stats so that they don't have to look at that thing because of, you know, guilt or anything else that we might be feeling at that time.
Okay. And then we have with Ginny, explain what your job is exactly.
So I guess Ginny has a couple different roles. So she's a researcher. She's also a counselor, and she collects data on low-income Asian women around stress and depression. So that's where most of her work is focused.
And there's an interesting premise, is there not, if you study race, because there's studying race at the same time that you're living it.
Right, definitely. I think that she sort of sees herself as one of the few Asian American women who have escaped their preordained role in our society, which is to, you know, get married and have kids and sort of be docile and diminutive. And so she sees herself as a voice for those who cannot speak. But going back to what you were saying about how there are so many monologues that are sort of fighting for attention over one another, I think that that's sort of what the characters are experiencing for themselves as well. I think they're all really smart people with their own agendas. And as well-meaning as they are, they're still having trouble hearing each other. And I think that that's part of what the play deals with.
I suppose if the theme is that we don't talk to each other about race, then we're sort of seeing that happen,
playing out.
And Jackson, tell us what's happening in that scene with the, you know, should you amputate, and what's happening with the, and there's an anger that comes up.
So it is important to understand that Jackson is not quite a surgeon yet. He's a resident in the process of training to become a surgeon. So he kind of goes against the person who's like over him, the main doctor. He amputates the toe of a patient. And although this is in the patient's best interest, you know, it conflicts with insurance. And the doctor that's presiding over him basically, you know, gets on him for that. So this is navigating like politics, as far as like with the healthcare. And then also, you know, he mentions in a monologue that, you know, a nurse came behind him and second guessed him, you know. His opinion is invalid because he's the black guy essentially in the very cerebral job, you know. So this speaks to, I think, what a lot of people of color experience in the workplace, you know, automatically being treated as inferior.
And we're going to hear more and talk more about the play Smart People, a very thought-provoking play at the University Theater, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking to Chuck Smith, the director of the University Theater production of Lydia Diamond's Smart People, a thought-provoking play about race, and three of its actors, Daniel Milhouse, Lucy Tan, and Kyle Agee. We heard from the characters and the different studies they're doing on race, the different experiences they're having. We have Harvard professor studying racism, sort of from a neuroscience point of view. We've got a Harvard young Asian American psychology professor studying discrimination and attitudes about Asian Americans. We've got a surgical intern, African American, struggling to not be judged unfairly with his work. But we also start having pairing up of characters. Can you talk about the sort of romantic side of this play?
Well, the Brian and Ginny, the they sort of they meet, and we're going to do a scene from where they meet, and then the two African American characters, they meet in a hospital. She has to have an emergency situation because she runs into something happened to her face, and I don't want to give anything away. And so she goes to the doctor, and she meets our doctor, and they kind of form an introduction to a relationship, and we see how difficult because they're such smart people, these relationships just don't seem to click, because everyone is still kind of locked into their own particular little area of expertise that they just don't want to give up what they got.
And when you say smart people, is that smart in quotes?
Yes, very much in quotes.
And it does seem as if each of the characters has a kind of wall built around himself or herself where they're not so open to other ideas.
And which is sort of the subtext of the play.
Yeah.
They're not really listening to each other. They're talking at each other rather than to each other.
I get the sense that Lydia Diamond is in part satirizing academia itself and the way that you can have at a university a diversity committee and studies on race and all kinds of things that are in the head that may not be getting to what's really happening on the ground or in people's hearts.
Yeah. That's why I'm so pleased to find this play in a college, because the youth of today are a lot different from those of us who've been tainted by what's going on in our society. And the play belongs in a college because that's where the conversation is going to begin. The real conversation is going to begin. And if things are going to change, it's these young people who are going to change it, not old fogies like myself.
No. I kind of have a feeling you're changing things with your directing. Let's take a look at the scene where Ginny and Brian arrive early for a diversity meeting and encounter each other. We'll pick it up.
Strange that if they wanted diversity institutionally, they wouldn't just hire some people of color, right?
Absolutely. You didn't tell me your name.
Brian. White?
Ginny. Half Chinese, half Japanese.
Brian White?
Of course. I see how I did that. And your work?
Cognitive neuroscience, when I can get to it. Recently, I've spent too much of my time teaching children.
Children?
Yes, indeed. At the leading research institution in the world, I'm stuck teaching 101 survey courses to undergrads. It's my penance.
What did you do? Wait a minute! Oh my God, you're that guy!
What?
Your op-ed! You started that whole race firestorm!
In the flesh. Are you Googling me? In front of me?
So, cognitive neuroscience.
I started in neuropsych and then sort of migrated to neuroscience.
Does one really migrate to neuroscience?
I did. I support sociological premises through brain imaging, chemistry analysis, biological data, that sort of thing. And you're Ginny Yang. Psychology golden girl.
I prefer Wunderkind. How do you know me?
I Googled you once. You weren't there. I've been criticized for focusing on too narrow a demographic. I was considering broadening my parameters to be more inclusive.
Of?
People other than blacks, whites, and Latinos.
So did you?
Huh?
Broaden your racial parameters.
No. No, I didn't.
Why?
There are too many of you, broadly Asians. No single social experience to speak of.
True.
It was untenable.
Untenable or inconvenient?
Untenable.
Fair enough. Have you done one of these diversity committee things before?
I'm the go-to white guy for these, because I study race, and of course, because I care. And you?
I generally decline. I don't know. I'm uncomfortable celebrating my marginalization with other disgruntled, marginalized people. It's not my job to make the institution behave appropriately. In truth, I lost a bet with a Middle Eastern man in my department. And I'm a toucan.
Toucan?
Token? Toucan. I proudly represent not one, but two underrepresented populations.
Underrepresented? Really? 'Cause I see your people everywhere.
Women?
The Asian people?
You're mistaken. My people mostly frequent the hard sciences.
As do I. I can't throw a stone without hitting a... My politics are such that I can make that joke with people who know me. Have dinner with me?
No.
I can do that better. Please, may I take you out to dinner?
No.
You're a psychologist.
Yes.
So you know how vulnerable a man is when asking a woman to dinner?
I don't study the science of mating rituals.
Not mating, just dinner.
Hmm.
I really did like your paper. And I'm not just flattering you because I've insulted you. Repeatedly.
Thank you.
And again, if you knew me... May I flatter you for just another second?
If you must.
I like the way you write. It's smart, accessible, well-argued. It was a good read. And there was a picture of you. You photograph well.
Thank you. What did your last girlfriend look like? Demographically speaking.
I don't date demographically.
Humor me.
Blonde, pretty, tall, sort of old money, good bone structure. And yours?
Mine?
Your demographic preferences. In men? If you date men, and that's totally cool if you don't.
Generally, I don't date. Can I see that? How do you... Oh, here. That's my number.
Okay. Thank you.
It's just my number, not a promise.
I'll keep that in mind.
And one thing we might want to sort of mention is that Jenny is always on her...
On her phone, yes.
On her phone. Yeah, she's her whole focus is cell phone, which is common today.
It is. And yeah. I think the play opens that way.
Yes, sort know, of. Yeah,
which definitely tells us we're in our own time.
Right.
Yep. So again, coming back to what I asked before about the play perpetuating stereotypes, if you have an Asian American character, you know, just sort of obsessed with technology and on her phone and very you know, talking about studies and excelling and being driven and not having as much of a romantic life, doesn't that perpetuate a lot of the stereotypes about Asian Americans rather than break through?
Well, that's what makes it dramatically interesting, is the fact that she is very successful and very good at what she does, and in her counseling sessions, which are throughout the whole play, we see how much help she is to the people who come to her. And so that sort of takes the stereotype and flips it on its top side, you know, when we actually see this woman working at what she does, you know. Now, her relationships with everybody else in the play is one you would look at it and say, oh yeah, that's stereotypical maybe. But when you see her in action, then you have a whole different opinion. And it's the same thing with these other characters. When you see them in action doing the thing that they really do, you understand that we are dealing with some very special individuals who know what they're talking about.
We had some wordplay there with Brian White where he says Brian White and she thinks he's sort of doing, you know, a self-description, Brian and I'm white. There's that. And then the term toucan, is that something that Lydia Diamond came up with or is that actually used? Toucan. I've never heard that.
I've never heard that.
I wouldn't
be surprised if Lydia heard it, you know, somewhere on the East Coast.
Yeah, but there is wit in these exchanges.
Yeah. And that's Lydia Diamond. She's very witty. And she always puts a lot of humor in her writing, you know. Because, you know, let's face it, humor is one of the things that eases an audience into a play. If you started off all heavy-handed right away. You're going to lose them right away. But add a little laugh, a few laughs in there, you got their attention. And then by the time you stop laughing, you're already hooked.
And if you start a play with someone on their cell phone too much at a dinner, you reach every family in America.
That's true.
Yeah. We are going to hear more from the play Smart People and meet our fourth actress when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Valerie Johnston. I'll be reading for Sholanda. I left my headshot with the monitor, but if you need one, okay then. I was loving you, Lenny. All that time you was looking at me, and I thought you was looking into my soul, and you wasn't seeing me at all. And I was looking at you, and I knowed you'd see something. I know there's a man in there, and I could see him, even if you couldn't. And Mama said, she said, "Nah, girl, he don't love you. He only love you long as you give him what he need, stay scared, and stand afoot." And I told her. Oh, okay. I told her. Okay. And I told her she was wrong. And I told her. I got it. Sorry, where should I begin? No, I can just start over. I'm so sorry. My agent didn't send the right side, so I'm reading this cold. I was told to prepare for Mary, the social worker. Oh, I seemed a better fit for this role. So did my agent tell you I have a call at 2? I'm doing Enemy of the People at the... Sure thing. From the top, then. I was loving you, Lenny. All that time you was looking at me, and I thought you was looking into my soul, and I... Oh, okay, sure. Thank you.
That's the character of Valerie in Lydia Diamond's play Smart People, as read by Aaliyah Boyd. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with director Chuck Smith. And in addition to Aaliyah Boyd, we have Daniel Milhouse, the part of Brian, the white neuroscientist showing that biologically whites are racist. Lucy Tan playing the part of Ginny, a Harvard psychology professor studying Asian American discrimination against Asian Americans, and then Kyle Agee playing the part of Jackson, an African American surgical intern in this play that stirs up all kinds of questions having to do about race. In that audition that we just heard, what is going on there, Aaliyah?
Well, Valerie's kind of a struggling actress in terms of trying to find roles that she really likes and that she, you know, wants to do that will help her be successful. And in this one, she comes in for an audition for what she thinks is going to be Mary, the social worker, who we assume is, you know, someone who doesn't speak in Ebonics, who's not the classic stereotype of the black woman. And instead, she gets to audition for Sholanda, who is the stereotypical black woman. And she's not extremely happy about it, and she doesn't quite understand the way the words are supposed to be said or what they really mean, because that may not really be the way she talks, but that's what she gets.
Yeah, and it's interesting because she wants to do Shakespeare, wants to do Ibsen,
yeah,
but this is the part that she tries out for. Chuck, as you heard that scene read, what went through your head?
Well, no, I mean, that's the life of the African-American female actress of today. Yeah, she's already in a play. She's doing Ibsen, so we know she can act. But what do they call her in for, you know? They call her in to do the nurse, and then when they look at her, as soon as they look at her, they say, "Oh, well, no, you should play this role," mm-hmm. You know. So just on the way she looks, they say, "This is the role we want you to play." It's stereotypical, you know. It happens all the time.
Earlier, we were looking at a scene between Ginny and Brian, where they are on a diversity committee together, and as they talk about their research and their papers, it gradually moves toward when they're exchanging phone numbers. We have with Valerie overlap with the part of Jackson, the African-American surgical intern that at first she doesn't think is the doctor and so on. Can you set up a scene between the two of them?
Well, we could go right to their first date, and which is Jackson has invited Valerie over to his house for dinner. And then after dinner, they get very cozy, and we pick it up when they're getting cozy.
I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought. Where was I?
House cleaning.
Right, house cleaning. Well, I used to make about 15 an hour, but if you're industrious, you can get as much as 35. You just go in and do an amazing job the first 5 times. Little tricks. You wash the windows, the light bulbs. It just sparkles and they don't know why. On the 6th week, you tell them you're sorry, but you realize you've overbooked. Usually they'll give you a raise right there. If they don't, they'll call 2 weeks later and say, name your price. And I say, well, if I squeeze you in on Tuesday mornings, I'd have to give up a job that pays 25 an hour. And there it is.
They kiss.
I've never done this before.
Really?
On a first date.
Technically mid-first date.
Really? And I'm not just saying that. I'm not a prude, but I've never...
I made a peach cobbler if you'd like dessert.
Okay.
I could get more, but we'd have to switch to red.
Unless you want more, but I'm good.
If you're sure. I have a nice Malbec.
Did your mama teach you to fry fish like that?
My grandmama. She's from Virginia.
Ah, that's why greens, cornbread, catfish, and peach cobbler. How do you eat like that and stay so... Well, it was delicious.
Thank you. I figured you liked it after your third piece.
2, 3.
I count it. There's nothing hotter than a woman with an appetite. I'm impressed and surprised that you handle a hot sauce bottle so well.
What are you saying?
The real test was when you asked for vinegar for the greens. That's downright sexy and a little hood.
I don't know what that means.
No, just...
You were testing me?
Whoa, don't get touchy.
You purposely didn't put the hot sauce bottle on the table to see if I would ask for it?
No.
So you wouldn't expect me to use condiments if I wasn't, how you'd say, down.
You are a little sadiddy. I wouldn't have presumed to know your relationship to hot sauce or vinegar.
Malbec, please.
Okay, and we'll skip over to page 47 and pick it up.
Truce, please. I cooked.
You know, to a sadiddy girl... Sadiddy's like fighting words.
I'm sorry.
When we were kids, my cousins in Detroit called me Sadiddy. But they wouldn't beat me up. They were industrious and would take me out to meet their friends, and I'd end up getting my proper talking she thinks she white ass beat. Every time.
They set you up.
Of course they did. And I never saw it coming. It's a nice name you have.
It was supposed to be presidential.
You must be a great disappointment.
Nah, my mom's very proud. I told her I'd be a surgeon when I was in the 4th grade, so I applied myself. You?
A great disappointment. Hugely disappointing. But they made their bed. They used to take me to all these cultural things. The ballet, the orchestra, plays. They served on all the boards. Not because of their undying love of the arts, but because they wanted to make me someone who could get into an Ivy League and graduate and make money. So there's tension. It'll be okay when I marry a rich doctor and stop this starving artist thing.
I just realized I have so much work tomorrow. We should call it a night.
You didn't just...
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. You're offended.
You dismissed me. I said one stupid thing. You're supposed to just not call me back, not end the date abruptly, especially after...
No, really. I'm tired. The curtain just came down. I've been on night shifts in emergency and then going directly to my clinic.
It's fine. I've got an early cleaning job tomorrow.
And I'm still not getting the whole house cleaning thing.
You don't have to.
Well, you're smart. Seems like your energies could go to something more productive.
I'm an actor.
Why?
Because it's what I do better than anyone else can. It's my contribution.
You don't think the housekeeping thing sets us back a little? My grandma and mom cleaned houses so I could go to medical school and make something of the family.
Not to help people?
Say what?
You went to med school to help people, yes?
And your deaf portrayal of Portia empowers our people how?
I volunteer for Obama.
I take bullets out of gangbangers.
What's wrong with you?
I've just never met somebody so incredibly well insulated. You volunteer for Obama as your whole black card?
You didn't ask me for my black card before you...
You didn't tell me you spread your legs prematurely because I'm a doctor.
So, thank you for dinner.
I can walk you to your car.
No, no, I'm good. Thank you. Actually, where's the bathroom?
And so that's the their first meeting, their first date.
There's so much that's bouncing back and forth yeah. between these two. What I'm struck by, too, is when I read this to myself, the script, it didn't come alive like that when I was just kind of in my head. But the two of you going back and forth, I can really hear the different, you know, attitudes going back and forth. Yeah. What do you think is important for an audience to get from that scene?
Well, mainly that how difficult it is for the African-American relationship to work, whether the individuals are educated or not educated. It's so much other stuff that comes into play that it's so much gets in the way. But I would imagine it's the same thing with any relationship, but with the African-American relationship, it's even more difficult.
Well, it's as if each word is almost a minefield. You know, it can trigger some all kinds of attitudes and flashbacks and problems, and you know, so that it, that everybody is kind of walking on tiptoes in
a certain
everyone's way.
Everyone's defensive and really just not, again, just not letting themselves be open to any type of criticism or innuendo.
I know that an audience can only get the experience of smart people by coming and seeing the whole show. But I'm thinking in the remaining minutes that we've got here, what I want to ask each of you to do is to tell me just in the sort of elevator speech length, what you hope an audience will walk out of the theater after seeing Smart People, or perhaps they've encountered it by reading the script or seeing it elsewhere at a different time. What do you hope they go out of the theater feeling or thinking that they didn't when they came in? If you do your job as director or actors properly, what kind of transformation might occur?
Well, I'll start it off. As a director, I want the audience to walk out and have a conversation with someone outside of their own comfort zone. Anyone. Just have a conversation, an honest conversation. About what's it like? This is how I feel about things. How do you feel about it? And take it on from there. That's what I hope happens.
Okay.
Yeah, to piggyback on that, I think theater is a safe place to do the unsafe things that need to be done. And I would say just having people talking about it would be great. Not only talking about it as in, oh, what did you learn from this? Because I hope the audience sees real people up there, not people giving these speeches and teaching, but it's these people living their lives through their viewpoints. And I hope the audience is affected by that in some way, that they care to share that and start a conversation.
And if you, as Brian White, do your job, what do you want them to think about Brian?
Oh, I would like them to think that, you know, I think one of the challenges we had talked about in our first day of rehearsal is because I'm the only white guy in the show, Brian could be seen as the villain because of all the topics I come up with race and the words that I say. So something that I'm trying to do is for people to see past that and see someone who genuinely cares about trying to solve this issue of race in society.
Okay, great. And the character of Jackson and what you, Kyle, think you want people to go out of the theater feeling or thinking?
For the play overall, I want people to walk away examining their own privilege and how it relates to how they interact with society. As far as Jackson, that typical archetype of the angry black man, I just want people to basically see that there's more facets to that character and that there are circumstances that, you know, contribute to that particular archetype. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And Lucy, with the portrayal of Ginny.
And
the play as a whole.
Yeah, I think with Ginny, I guess it's important for me to have the audience understand the multiple issues that she's sort of battling in her life. So there's the question of being marginalized as an Asian American, and there's the question of being marginalized as a woman. And I think those are both issues that are really important that we talk about. And with regard to the play, you know, I think this play is really important for everyone to see. I think it's especially important for people of this particular community in Madison, Wisconsin to see, especially with, you know, all of the underlying racial tensions that have really come to light in a very public way in the past year. I think now, it's not only an opportunity, but I think we have to think of it as a responsibility to talk about these questions.
And you,
Julia? For me, as Valerie, I really want people to realize that, there, again, with the angry black person in general, there's not only one level to the black woman. You know, it's not always the angry black woman, the controlling black woman. And for my own community, you know, it's not always, we don't always have to be the strong black woman either. And that showing vulnerability and being vulnerable is not, you know, something that makes us weak. And in some cases, it doesn't even make us stronger. And I just guess for the show as a whole, I really want people to walk away having looked at the world from someone else's viewpoint, or being willing to take that step to ask someone, you know, how do you see yourself in this world? How do you feel you fit here? And being willing and open to understand them and know, okay, their viewpoint may be different from mine, the way they experience the world may be different from mine, but that doesn't mean that we can't relate to each other.
It's interesting how each character at some point in the play will use the phrase "your people," you know, or try to make blanket assumptions about a whole group. And when we're sitting in the audience, we hear that happening back and forth and can kind of get an overview of a larger picture of race. What else, Chuck, would you hope that people will go out of that theater? So you want them to have conversations. You want them to enter into the experience of someone from a different group. What else would be?
Well, one would, in Fantasyland, the play is so good. It changes lives, and it changed the way you think about things. That's fantasy land. But you know, you can have
is
that.
It?
You can have that fantasy if you want to.
Well,
you know, but, I don't know.
As a professor of English literature, I have seen students, and just, you know, I work with all kinds of outreach audiences. I've seen people's lives changed when they read a book or see a play because you imagine a different world or you see yourself in a character. I've seen it happen.
Yeah. I'm an ex-professor also, and I've seen it happen. and I've seen it happen in the theater also. But it's rare. It's rare. But a play like this is so raw and right in your face that you can't ignore it. And that's what I like about it. And you're going to have something on your mind when you walk out of the theater. So just do something about whatever's on your mind. That's all I want them to do.
Yeah. Yesterday, as I was reading through Smart People, the script, my 8-year-old granddaughter was playing with stuffed animals of all different colors. And I asked her what she was doing. And she said, "I'm playing racism." And I thought, oh, no, what is this? But she was, because of Martin Luther King Day at school, she was actually organizing the different animals of different colors and having them not treat each other right and then work out solutions and come up with a different way of all being together on the couch. And I thought, you know, theater allows you to play. It allows you to play act, to take on different roles and to regroup.
And that's a smart kid.
But it shows the joy of theater, really.
It shows the joy of theater, but it shows some smart parents, too. You know, some very good parenting, I think. You know.
Well, the production is Smart People, and I've been talking to the director, Chuck Smith, and four actors who are the four characters in this play. We've heard from Daniel Milhouse, Lucy Tan, Kyle Agee, and Aaliyah Boyd. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and you've been listening to University of the Air.